All the best. Stories from Sydney.
On FBI.
You're listening to FBI 94.5. Welcome to All the Best. My name is Imogen Semler and I'm filling in for Eliza Salos while she's away for a couple of months. A big thanks to Luke Rodley for taking us through the Saturday overhang. On All the Best, we usually bring you stories from Sydney, but today our theme is travellers, and so we're bringing you stories from around the globe. Coming up over the next hour, we're going to find out what it's like to be bare-bottomed and mangled after being run over by a tank in Kabul. We'll visit a Greek island with a very strong connection to Sydney, and we'll also hear what it's like to grow up as a diplomat. Yep, that's a child of a diplomat. A few years ago, I spent 5 months in India, and I took my audio recorder with me, and just now we're listening to some of the sounds of my travels. I also met some interesting people along the way, and we'll be hearing from a few of them today as well. To get things started, let's head to an ashram in northern India, where I met James.
We are at the ashram in India. I'm talking to James. James, where are you from?
I'm from England, North Yorkshire.
What have you been doing in India?
I've been travelling and I have been doing some volunteer teaching. So it's pretty much half and half, volunteering just to save the pennies and travelling to have fun, really.
And how long have you been here?
6 months.
Already?
Yeah.
And how long are you going to stay?
Maybe 3 more years. I don't know. As long as the money lasts, and as long as I can, basically.
The long stay traveller. What's the appeal to stay?
I've got no desire to go back home.
Why?
Because it's cold. I don't know. It's just a completely different lifestyle. I'm just absolutely loving the freedom. And all the meeting all the new people, and if you're not concerned about security and about having a nice house by the age of 27, then why not do something like this?
Very good point. And what have you learned from the ashram this week?
I've learned that I'm not ready to lead a spiritual life just yet. I want to have a lot more fun because I've been going insane these last few days.
Well, I know what I know, and I go where I go, but my head's stuck in the sand. And I play what I play, and I say what I say, and I do it anywhere I can. All the people I see stay stuck like a tree to their one little hole in the ground. Man, that's not me, no, it ain't gonna be me. I like to roam around. Well, I'm a traveling man.
Well, I'm a traveling man.
Little old traveling man.
A little traveling man.
I know what I know, and I go where I go. Well, I'm a traveling man.
Well, you're listening to All the Best with me, Imogen Semler, and I'm filling in for Eliza Salos. And today we're bringing you stories about travellers. I just played you Travelin' Man by Sydney band The Pipes. Now, it could be argued that contemporary Australia is a nation built on migrants. And there are migrant stories, but there are also migrant stories. And even though producer Madeline James had travelled all over the world, she wasn't expecting to find a Greek island quite so close to home. Here she is.
A few years ago, I spent a very long grey winter living in London. So when my friend Mark proposed that we start our European summer visiting the island where his grandparents were born, I was just happy to go anywhere that promised sunshine. I'd never heard of this Greek island, Kastellorizo, and Mark thought there mightn't be much to do. We decided to stay a couple of days, max. But when we arrived in the island, it was like stepping into a Greek cliché. There were blue tables and chairs perched by the water's edge, boats bobbed in the harbour, grapevines were draped over just about everything, an octopus was drying in the morning sun. Before we'd ordered a Greek coffee, before we organised our accommodation, we went straight to the travel agent and changed our tickets. We were staying for a week, minimum. It was May, and the summer season had yet to begin. We felt like we had discovered a forgotten jewel in the Aegean.
Chagalana tu egeunera,
If you go hunting for Castellorizo on a map of Europe, it's most likely you won't find it. A tiny dot off the coast of Turkey, Castellorizo is as far east as you can go while still being in the EU. It's so far east, in fact, it just doesn't fit on most maps of Europe. Locals call it the Rock. At just 5 square miles, covered in mostly inhospitable rock and scrub, with no source of fresh water, it doesn't sound like much of a place to live. But Castellorizo is home to one of the most perfect natural harbours in the Mediterranean. And over the centuries, that harbour has been hot property. Castellorizo is a small rock with a big history. Castellorizo was a safe rest stop for the Knights of St. John when they were coming and going from the Crusades. It has sheltered pirates, merchants, boat builders and traders. And sitting just 2 kilometres from the Turkish coastline, it has been ruled by both Greece and the Ottoman Empire, as well as Italy and Britain during the 20th century. Only 100 years ago, the island was home to a thriving community of more than 12,000 people. Photos from the 1920s show the hillsides around the harbour crammed with elegant Venetian-style villas built with Ottoman features. But the town that Mark and I were wandering around was tiny. No more than a handful of restaurants and houses amidst a whole lot of empty hillside. One block back from the waterfront and the laneways were a tangle of ruins. Bougainvillea grew through smashed-in windows and caved-in roofs. Elegant veranda beams held up nothing but the sky. So what happened to this island? And where did all the people go? The first real wave of migrants began leaving in the 20s, prompted by the Italian occupation and the devastating earthquake of 1926. Those who stayed were shipped off to refugee camps in Lebanon during the Second World War, and when they returned, they found their homes obliterated by bombardments and fire. Their boats destroyed, their homes burnt down, there was little left to stay for. Like many post-war refugees, they packed up their stuff and boarded boats for a new life somewhere else. But unlike most refugees, they didn't disperse in some worldwide diaspora. The population made their way almost exclusively to Australia. And while there's a large community in Perth where the boats first landed, the bulk of the descendants of this tiny rock in the Aegean live in Sydney, mostly in or around the suburb of Kensington. And there were clues, of course. One of the restaurants on the harbourfront was called Sydney Cafe. And then there were the ruins with Australian mobile numbers scrawled on their walls. And everyone Mark met seemed to have some family connection with someone he knew back in Sydney. Having spent some time in Castellorizo, I wanted to meet the Australian Castellorizians. When I came back to Sydney, Mark put me in touch with his great uncle and aunt, Jim and Mary Condelius. In true Greek style, they treated me to Greek coffee and an enormous slice of baklava, and they talked about the past.
Well, when I came to Australia, of course, all I can say was one word. Everything people say to me, I will say, never mind.
Jim came to Australia in 1946 as a 16-year-old, and for the last 20 years he has been writing articles for the Castellorizo newspaper, which is published in English and Greek for the Australian Kazis. He is pretty much the definitive source of information on the island.
Here in Australia today, we've got over 30,000 Castellorizian descendants.
And what's the population on the island?
Today, on the island, is 120 permanent. About 80 live in Rhodes and visit the island quite often, nearly every second, third week.
The shocked voice you can hear in the background belongs to Jim's wife, Mary.
But if you ask the mayor, he'll tell you there's over 200, 240. Because by doing this, he gets money from the government.
As you can hear in their voices, Jim and Mary are quite sceptical about the way the island is run these days. So I was surprised to learn that neither of them had been born on the island, nor ever lived there. Jim was born in Alexandria, in Egypt, while Mary was born and raised in Goulburn, New South Wales.
But you're from Castellorizo.
Yeah, the blood is there.
Mm-hmm. And so when did you first go to Castellorizo?
I went in 1976 with my wife.
And this was the first time?
First time for me.
How was that?
Very emotional. I got very emotional because I've been writing so much about it. I've been telling people about it. My father was a captain of the sea because he had his own boat, and everything was about Castellorizo in my life as I grew up. Everything. Even my mother had to visit Castellorizians in their neighborhood in Alexandria to talk about the past. I got all trembling. My body felt trembling when I saw the harbor.
Despite their strong emotional ties to the island, or perhaps because of them, Jim and Mary feel particularly angry about the way the island is presently run.
I mean, every time you hear some people talking from Castellorizo, they all say that it's their property and what do you want to come back here for?
They run down the Australian Greeks.
That's one of the reasons I don't want to go back there. Yeah.
There is a perceived problem with squatters on Castellorizo who have taken property not belonging to them. Jim's sister's house has one such squatter living in it.
Inside me, I curse the people live there because of bringing the island to the position it's got to.
Castellorizo has a system of matrilineal inheritance, meaning that the house goes to the daughters, not the sons. Mary inherited a house from her mother, but sold it quite a few years ago. It just proved too difficult managing it from the other side of the world. Not only will they not be moving back there, neither Mary nor Jim would like to be buried on Castellorizo.
No, I don't want to be buried there. I've got a mother here, brothers.
One sister.
And I'm sure I don't. I already made arrangements. I bought two plots of land here at Botany, next to my mother-in-law, to keep my wife happy.
Well, it happened that it was available.
That's the way she wanted it. That's the way I did it.
Over the years, Castellorizo has taken on an almost mythological significance in the lives of the descendants in Australia. And the sense of their tight-knit Australian Castellorizan community started very early on with the first wave of migrants. In 1924, they opened a cafeneo on top of a shop in Park Street, Sydney.
On top of a shop, and they call it the cafeneo. Cafeneo, oh well.
It was a gambling place. gambling place.
And all you do there, you just play cards.
And have a coffee.
And rice pudding.
In 1951, the cafeneo was closed and the Kazis moved up to Oxford Street.
Number 66 Oxford Street. All the Greeks that were getting there every Sunday, it was chock-a-block. You couldn't get in on Sunday.
Then in 1970, they bought the old Odeon Picture Theatre in Kensington and opened the Castellorizan Club. It doesn't exist now, but Jim says people are often asking if it will reopen. But there's lots happening in Sydney that keep the Castellorizan community together. The Castellorizan Ladies Auxiliary keep the old customs and traditions alive by teaching cooking and dancing to younger generations. There's even a Castellorizan nursing home in Kensington. The Kazis like to say they're more Greek than the Greeks. And winds of change are blowing into the protected harbour of Castellorizo. Australian Kazis are returning to the island in greater and greater numbers, reclaiming old houses, running seasonal restaurants, and bringing their children to visit their heritage. Every July, the tiny plane from Rhodes brings what seems like the entire suburb of Kensington to the island. Kids who play together in Randwick Primary School swim together in the harbour at Castellorizo. At the entrance to the harbour, the locals have erected a statue of the Kazi symbol. It's a cross, an anchor, and a heart.
The cross is the religion. The heart is the love. And the anchor is the faith. We all fishermen and boat owners and sponge diggers, or whatever they call them, divers.
Do you say it in Greek?
In Greek?
Yeah.
Thrishkia?
Yeah. Faith.
Agape.
Love.
Ke.
Hope.
Unlike my friend Mark, I don't have any ancestral link to this island. I don't have cousins to discover or homes to claim. But this small rock in the Aegean has anchored itself in my heart. Without a doubt, I will be going back.
Idomenus. Kavafistithaki. That's Kavati. Kavati, he was a book writer. The English is, hope the voyage is a long one. May there be many summer mornings when, with what pleasure, what joy, you come into harbors seen for the first time.
Thanks to Madeline James for that story, and also thanks to Jim and Mary Candelius and their nephew Spiro Pandalakis for sharing their tales of Castellorizo, the Greek island that moved to Sydney. It's Imogen Semler with you today on All the Best, and it's all about travellers. So let's hear a track from the Department of Eagles with Green Rocky Road.
Well, it's a green rocky road, promenading green. Tell me who y'all are. Tell me who you love.
Stories from Sydney on All the Best.
I was with two friends, and we always took turns. For some reason, we had no money at all, so for some reason, we always shared one room. We never got two rooms. And one person always had the shit bed. So that bed could be just something, a mat on the floor, or it could be some sort of a cot. Yeah. And whoever's turn it was for the shit bed just had to accept and could never, ever, ever, ever grumble. And that was the unspoken rule, and nobody ever grumbled. Okay. And it was my turn for the shit bed. So we were on the sleeper bus and my friends all got all tucked up into their nice double bed, really big, lots of space. And this was in Rajasthan in the middle of the summer, so it was like 50 degrees outside, no aircon on the bus. Yeah, my bed was in the middle at the back of the bus.
I saw that.
And I didn't have a curtain.
Like a,
it's like a stretcher.
Yeah.
And the whole bus is sitting up looking at me because I'm the only one who doesn't have a curtain. So I thought that was bad enough. It was exactly like a stretcher. But then this woman claims that she bought that bed, that was her bed. And she was part of a family who took the other double bed on the other side of the stretcher. And there must have been about 15 people sharing that double bed, seriously. So she physically couldn't get into that space. So in the end, there was nothing we could do other than share this stretcher of a bed, which is literally the size of a stretcher.
Yeah.
It's like... And her being Indian, she's got no sense of personal space or privacy. She's just lying on top of me, breathing into my ear all night long, boiling hot. This Indian woman lying on top of me, a child lying on top of me. And then I woke up in the middle of the night, and between my legs, God knows how there was space between my legs, but between my legs, there was an Indian guy sitting. A man. So I lost my temper then and kicked him off and shouted at him to get off. Yeah.
On FBI 94.5, it's All the Best with me, Imogen Semler. And that was Suzanne from Newcastle in the UK. I met her on my travels in India a few years ago, and that was a story she told us one night around the dinner table of a not-so-comfortable bus ride in Rajasthan. Today we're bringing you stories about travellers. And next up we're going to hear what it's like growing up overseas as the child of a diplomat. It can be a blessing, but it can also be a bit of a curse. Sociologists call them third culture kids, young people who grow up trading cultures the way others trade music. Amongst their ranks, they boast the current US president. They're more likely than anyone else to go to uni and finish their degree, but 90% of them admit to feeling isolated and out of place around their peers. Dom Dietrich grew up in a few different places. His mum was a diplomat in Nepal and Papua New Guinea. He spoke to Michael Safi about the blurry line between going away and coming home.
For most of us, travel, seeing another place and culture, is a break away from normal life. But what if moving around was normal life? What if your home was a place where everyone spoke a different language to you and looked and dressed completely differently? They call kids who grew up like that third culture kids, not part of their native culture or the culture in which they grew up, but instead a third culture that they construct out of their experiences. I go to uni with one of them. Dom Dietrich grew up in a few different places. Here he is.
Yeah. Exhilarating stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I was born in Canberra. Don't hold that against me. But I don't actually have any memory of Canberra because then we moved to Brisbane and Brisbane was Brisbane. And then when I was about five, we moved to Nepal for about 3 years. That was certainly a great experience. And then after Nepal, when I was about 8 or 9, this would be in about 1996, went to Papua New Guinea. And that was for another 3 years. You can start to see the trend. It's a bit of a diplobrat trend. 3 years, 2.5 years.
Diplobrat.
And then came back to Australia.
Dom's mum worked for the Australian government, and her posts would go for 3 years, and then the whole family had to move again. And so at age six, Dom went travelling, except he never came back home. And then home just kind of withered away.
I don't really remember the act of moving. From Brisbane to Nepal, if I try and think about it now, I have this existence in Brisbane and then I have this existence in Nepal, and kind of the existence in Nepal really starts, I remember, from a sixth birthday, which felt like it happened literally as I hopped off the plane. And then moving from Nepal to Papua New Guinea, once again, it's almost as if there is this black spot in your memory where you're not quite, you've just kind of transitioned to a new location.
Do you remember being happy about it or sad about it or just kind of going with the flow?
Well, leaving Nepal was sad. Nepal, even now, I'm sure, is just an incredibly beautiful country.
Dom came home, or rather, back to Australia at age 11, and he talks about the culture shock that came with it. Imagine moving somewhere you barely remember and being told that this was your home, and everything you thought home was, that was just travelling.
You have that sadness, but then when I came back to Australia, it wasn't so much that you'll miss the past, because you know you have that idea if you leave a country and you go to a new one, and you miss the old one. It wasn't so much I missed them, it was more just a sense of confusion with where you are now. And as I say, you know, the classic idea is that of culture shock.
For Dom, the challenge wasn't just figuring out how Australians spoke and our sports and that stuff. Becoming Australian was like joining a tribe, buying into the illusion that other people, people who aren't Australian, are somehow different. But he could never believe that. He had grown up in too many different places, he had seen too many different cultures. If it was a case of us and them, which side would he be on? He told me about a time when he was in Nepal and he was walking down the street and a woman invited him in for dinner. Here he was, a little Australian kid, alone, eating dinner with a Nepalese family.
From an experience like that, you definitely get a sense that there really is fundamentally not much difference in the impulses that drive people. It's the same bed. Sadly, it's only one bed for eight people, but there's still that impulse for shelter. Still that sense of food. Food is a way of almost an act of diplomacy. You know, it's common with everyone. Food is a place where you meet, you chat, and you share, and you show respect to people with that. Smiling, chatting, getting to know the background. I mean, all of the fundamentals are there. You know that people are similar. Not in an abstract way. You feel it.
Dom's been back a while now. With time, Sydney has become a home. But because the roots aren't deep, he says he could easily pack up and go.
At the moment, man, I'm really enjoying Sydney, so I don't have any sense of desperation to leave it. But if I were to leave it, it'd be fine. You get used to, because you've done it a few times, severing those social ties and just going, that's cool, broken, move on, meet new friends in a new location. You get almost good at it. You get good at breaking those ties, keeping some of them. Especially with modern social media, it'd be quite easy. Breaking them, moving elsewhere, setting up new ones. It's not like you don't want to move because of the fact that you don't want to lose your social ties.
Wouldn't you miss your friends, though?
You'd make new ones. I mean, that's the thing. Maybe it's a problem. Maybe it's a sign that your friendships aren't as deep as they should be and they're a bit superficial. I don't know. But you go, I'll keep them. And then when I come back or they come to this new place, we'll hang out just like old times. But I'll make new ones.
You know, while he says he could leave any time, make new friends in a new home, I just don't think it's that easy. You can't just shake off the people and the places in your past. They made you. And when Dom talks about his childhood, you can hear it in his voice. He still carries these places.
I remember the other day I was watching a documentary about Everest, and it was this incredible footage taken from the very top of Everest. I think it's the first time anyone did cinematography from the top of Everest. And I remember watching it, and the next day, I found it really hard to not constantly think about that. And thinking about it would almost, it didn't bring tears, but it certainly brought a strong sense of longing. And I was thinking, why? And I remember because for 3 years, when I was like 6, 7, 8, we did a lot of treks in the Himalayas. Trekked right next to Mount Everest, not same height, but the valley just a couple of valleys down. So when you're at the top of peaks, you could see Mount Everest. And there's a certain type of environment. There's not much vegetation. There's really dramatic topography, sheer cliffs, a lot of rock. You've got snow around, and it's got its own signature. And I realized in some sense, you miss that as well. And it's confusing because it's not like I could say, I miss it like I miss home, because you'd think, well, you're not Tibetan, you're not Nepalese, you're not a Sherpa. That isn't your home, because culturally it's not my home, you know. But in terms of the territory, you do have that same longing, that same sense of just missing it, and really, really, almost desperately just wanting to board a plane, land in Kathmandu, hop on a chopper, fly through the valleys, land in Lukla, climb the peak, look around, and do feel almost in some sense like you're back home in that sense.
That was Third Culture Kid, Dom Dietrich, speaking to Michael Safi about growing up as a child of a diplomat. You're listening to FBI 94.5. It's All the Best with me, Imogen Semler. And today we're bringing you stories about travellers. So now, let's head to Paris 2004 with Peter, Bjorn and John. Stories from Sydney on All the Best.
So, Caitlin, tell me about your trip in India.
You've done some cool things.
Yeah, here.
Yeah. Like,
I guess the most unique thing is the farm. You want me to tell you about it?
Yeah.
Okay, I found this organic farm, and it's like owned by this guy who, you know, has like is intensely into philosophy, and so he didn't want to be like a normal Indian, get married to some girl who he doesn't know and pays him a dowry. So he like made this farm, and he lived there alone in like a hut with no electricity for like 6 years or something, and then eventually sort of like built a house, and then eventually got married and like had a kid and built a little guest house. So it's like a retreat, like a philosophical retreat / organic farm. And so I went there and would do farm work, but also like read Eastern philosophy. And it's the only time in India I felt like I could be sort of on this equal relationship to the like farming class here. And it was really, really nice. Like, they would laugh at me when I couldn't do the rice right and like pull my machete away and be like, hee hee, stupid, try it this way. And
So cute.
Yeah, it's very special to be able to just be in there every day, just seeing life, you know, like a little boring, but I thought that was good.
On FBI 94.5, that was Caitlin from the US. I met her on my travels in India a few years ago. And yes, just in case you haven't guessed, today on All the Best, the theme is travellers. My name is Imogen Semler. I'm filling in for Eliza Salos. And now we're off to the Middle East. There are so many risks associated with travelling in a war zone, but as a Western woman experiencing everyday life on the streets of Kabul, a dangerous blow can come in the most unlikely of places. Elise Mole tells the story.
I knew I was in for an adventure when I arrived in Kabul, but looking down at my foot, hanging limp from my leg and exposing my ass in the middle of a crowded and dusty Afghan road wasn't the kind of adventure I had in mind. The day this all happened was the day before the Kabul conference, where world leaders were in town to map out the future of the war-riddled country. Security, even more than usual, was tight. The main arterial roads were closed, and people advised to stay at home. It was midsummer, and I had just arrived in Kabul to work on an assignment with a friend and fellow journalist, Travis Beard. I was captivated by the city. Families crowding into cars, burqa-clad women, sometimes five or six squeezed into the back. Kalashnikovs slung over the shoulder of every uniformed man surveying the dusty streets. the telltale signs of Kabul, horns tooting, helicopters overhead, and prayer music. Travis and I left the house on the motorbike to spend an afternoon exploring the city and picking up supplies for our new project. I heard the crash before I felt it. The bike spilled to the ground, skidding several metres on the dusty road. I couldn't see what had struck us because my face was tangled in my headscarf. Confounded as to why pain was surging through my body, I began to wonder if I'd been shot. Maybe Travis had been shot. Still attached to the bike, he spun around to check on me. "Are you okay?" "I'm okay," I lied. Shock was hiding the true extent of the pain. "We've been hit by a car," Travis said. A slight understatement given it was a 4-ton armoured SUV designed to resist roadside bombs. Our motorcycle hadn't even made a scratch, let alone a dent. Travis and I soon realised that my foot, like the motorbike, had come off second best. An open wound, mangled and contaminated with dirt and gravel. As Travis helped me onto the ground, onto my good foot, I saw my left foot, bereft of any skin or structural support that held everything in place, limply hanging from my leg, disgorging sinew and tendons and pissing blood. Two Russian occupants got out of their vehicle and began yelling accusations at us in Russian. They were from the Russian embassy. The commotion attracted a crowd of Afghans speculating in Dari over what they were witnessing. In shock, I began shouting, "Hospital! Hospital!" at the puzzled onlookers. The onlookers did not reach out. Probably out of deference of local sensitivities to women, after 30 years of civil war and invasion from foreign forces, what else is there to do but bear witness? Someone did reach out, a Russian diplomat, wearing a crisp, clean shirt. He tried to lead me to his car. Fearing I was being kidnapped, I panicked. Travis returned to assure me they had offered to drive us to the hospital in the Goliath-like vehicle that hit us. The Japanese-funded hospital on the Ministry of Interior Road was only a few hundred metres away. When we arrived, Travis lifted me onto a bed inside a dimly lit room. The policeman, who entered the room with us, pointed out a tear in the backside of my brown cotton trousers. Suddenly, my headscarf was yanked off my shoulders and wrapped around my bottom. Better a woman's head be seen than a naked buttock. In Afghanistan, women must cover their rear with loose, non-fitting clothing in public at all times. Values held by Afghan society reinforce these gender roles. So do prying Afghan policemen. However, the doctors who administered the first aid ignored the hole in my pants and focused on treating my injury. They soon realised the repairs were beyond their expertise. We were told an orthopaedic surgeon at Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital would be able to help. With this knowledge, Travis loaded me into a wheelchair to take me outside with the prerogative of negotiating another ride from the Russians. Outside, the policeman investigating the incident was talking to the crowd of Afghans who might have been witnesses and the Russians. We became the centre of a heated debate in Russian, Dari and broken English over who was responsible for the incident. Not knowing the language, I sat in the wheelchair, in the dust, watching my bandaged foot drip blood onto Travis's boots. Finally, we were back in the vehicle, travelling again toward Kabul's major hospital in Wazir Akbar Khan. At the hospital, I noticed two female Afghan nurses sitting on the bed, waiting for something to do. Their eyes widened at my arrival. The unscrupulous policeman hadn't left my side throughout the ordeal and was pushing me to answer his important questions about my marital status. I wondered what this had to do with his investigation. I now know that a married woman earns more respect than a single woman. After a great deal of persistent questioning, I told him Travis was my husband. He remained suspicious of my story and continued to seek out the truth, slowing down the progress of the doctors. He tried to explain to me in limited English that my family would not be happy about this accident and I should press charges against my husband for trying to kill me. Trying to kill me, I guess, by having an SUV crash into the rear of his motorbike. The policeman, with his big miscreant grin, urged me to make a statement to confirm his aforementioned conclusion. In that moment of immense frustration, I yelled at him to leave me alone. I sat on the hospital trolley in the room alone, wondering how it all got to this. And why was no one attending to my deformed foot? It took a series of documents to be signed and stamped, and my bill paid up front, the equivalent of $6, before any surgery could start. X-rays showed my foot was fractured, and on further inspection, doctors discovered the tendons in my foot were severed. I was taken up to the second floor surgery via a rickety lift. Travis left me at the door of the theatre. Going into surgery, I asked the doctor if I would be able to walk again. He smiled and said, "Yes, you will run." Word had spread throughout the hospital that there was an injured foreign woman. It was seemingly mandated for every doctor to drop by theatre for a look. About a dozen doctors passed through, each asking the same dozen questions. After the last stitch was painfully tied off, a plaster cast was moulded to my foot. My situation was starting to look better. But where was Travis? He had disappeared from the waiting room, replaced by Hamid, an Afghan friend I knew. "Where's Travis?" I asked. "He's been arrested," Hamid replied. The doctor told me I would have to make a statement at the police station to have him released. However, there was a catch. I couldn't be discharged from hospital without my husband's permission, a trifle difficult considering he was in a police cell. After a great deal of persistence, Hamid managed to get hold of Travis on his mobile phone at the police station. He handed the phone to the doctor, who accepted Travis's verbal permission to discharge me. I was carried out of the hospital on a stretcher. Hamid and his friend Gulistan, who had kindly brought a car, were forced to carry me nearly a kilometre to where they had parked, due to the oppressive security that day. Unlike the Russians, Gulistan didn't have diplomatic number plates. An hour later, across town, I was brought to the police station where Travis was detained. In the meantime, he had negotiated his way out of incarceration. After all this, the same policeman investigating the incident deemed it necessary to accompany us back to the house where we lived. The ordeal was soon over, despite his lingering suspicions, when I signed a statement translated into Dari saying I was married to Travis and that he was not trying to kill me. I have returned to Australia. After many doctor visits, I now know the true extent of my injuries. Complex, multiple fractures, known as a Lisfranc fracture, and two severed tendons. I can walk again, although it has taken me 6 months to get back on my feet. I have a large, impressive, winged-shaped scar on my foot, which I am told will fade, but I quite like the idea that it will be there forever. No scar, no story.
Surviving to tell the tale. That was Sydney-based journalist and adventurer Elise Moll, and thanks to the ABC's Correspondence Report, where that story was first aired. On FBI 94.5, it's Imogen Semler with you today on All the Best, and we've been bringing you stories about travellers. And now I'd like to take you back to India one final time. We're going to hear from Thomas, a guy I met in Delhi who had a particular passion for cows.
I'm Thomas from Austria.
Tell me about the cows.
You should tell you about the cows. Which cows?
Start in Austria.
Start in Austria, okay. In Austria, I was a cow herd on the mountains, and I had 68 cows. Well, it was 66 female and 2 ox. And I just took care that they have enough water to drink, enough salt. And if they were sick, I tried to give them medicine or give some cream on their legs if they were not good.
So how did you become a cow herder?
I became a cow herd because when I came back from India last year, I was missing all the cows, and then I heard that the cows need a herder. And so I became the herder, and I had cows around me. And this is why I'm back to India again, because I would miss the cows in Austria after they're all gone.
Why do you love cows?
Why do I love cows? Because I love them sitting on the freeway, in the middle of the freeway, in the traffic, being so quiet, and like in Varanasi, where you can feel that they feel that they are holy and they're arrogant. And then when I was on the mountain, I could see that why people love cows, because they're just wonderful, loving beings.
So you fell in love with cows when you came to India? Was it all before that?
Well, maybe before that, but basically I think it started when I came to India. Yeah, it was in Gokarna in South India when I started to watch cows.
And tell me about, so you also write articles about cows?
Yeah, I'm writing cow stories every month, a story about cows in India. And
have you met any interesting cows this trip?
Yeah, I met two cows that were correct from. They had the same character as as cows that I knew from the mountains. One very nasty one, a nice one also. I saw interesting cows, like I saw today in Delhi when I was walking around, that they need some more care.
What's the story you're writing at the moment?
The story at the moment is that I want to follow a cow or a couple of cows through Delhi, just see what they're doing when they get up, when they're milked, and where they're going, if the people they're visiting are knowing them, and just go with the cows for a couple of days. If you meet a herd of cow, 10 cows, then you go there and you get in contact with them, and you will see there is one or two who want to talk also to you and not only you to them. So these will be the cows that I will pick.
Today on All the Best, you've been listening to stories about travellers. My name's Imogen Semler, and thanks to our contributors for the show, Madeline James, Mike Safi, and Elise Mole. Today's show was produced by Catherine Lim. All the Best is produced by Eliza Salos and Jesse Cox, and our executive producer is Bridget Dagg. Don't forget you can podcast this episode and all our previous episodes at fbiradio.com. Coming up next week, we take a look at the power of the song. We're going to whisk you away to the safe sex music of Africa. We'll hear how moving to a new city can sometimes unleash the power of a song. We'll speak with two sisters whose life transformed as refugees coming to Australia when their musical careers went on the rise. And we'll look at how Christian music has grown and developed in recent time. Join us from 10 a.m. next Saturday on All the Best. I've been filling in for Eliza Salos, and she's away for the next couple of months. But don't go anywhere today. We've got Kate Jinks coming up next with Too Much, a show about all things film. To take us out right now, we're listening to a track from Lemon Jelly from their Lost Horizons album. They're a duo from the UK. Sadly, they broke up a couple of years ago. Check this out.
I'm a ramblin' man.
Yep, this song is called Ramblin' Man. He's a loose-footed traveller who reminds us of so many beautiful places to visit in this story-filled world. See you later.